In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
The Mighty Manfred and his coolest conversations time in Little Steven's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. Got a very unique program for you today. It's the coolest conversations I did live at the Stardust Theater on this year's Underground Garage cruise, which sailed April the 3rd through the 7th from Miami to Cozumel, Mexico. And on the 4th, while we were at sea, I interviewed both lead singer Jay Buchanan and guitar player Scott Holiday of the Rival Sons. We spoke for about 30 minutes, and the pair played acoustically, both at the beginning and at the end of the program. And we hear it now in its entirety. It's the Rival Sons for today's coolest conversations in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I could get through the day, I'll have a date with the moon. So I'll spend all my worthless time on the sand, thinking that my ship will be coming in soon. Look at these hands, they've been in gloves for years. So I'll spend all my worthless rounds in the ring, waiting for the other guy to disappear. But you and your fear. It's a brilliant Roman candle, separates the day from the night. It's that clean, clear truth. The swords are the wrong from the right. You and your face. If I could get through tonight, I'm waking up with my wings. No way I can sleep my way through a fight. Think I'm gonna unlock what tomorrow brings. Look at my eyes, don't even know who I am. So I'll spend all my worthless time on the floor, waiting for you. It's a brilliant Roman candle, separates the day from the night. It's a clean, clear truth. The swords are the wrong from the right. You and your face of love. that will you shave my head and wash the world from my mouth? Will you whisper in my head? Let me dance inside your
Thank you very much. Please allow us to bring out the mighty Manfred.
Sure, yeah. Woo! Ahoy, mateys. Wow, how about that, man? How about that? Please put your hands together again here.
Thank you all.
Debbie Cannon, Scott Holiday from the Rival Sons. That was really awesome. You guys limbered up now?
Yeah.
Limbered up. You can chat a little bit now.
We thought it was more appropriate that we bring the mighty man.
Exactly.
For if you caught the, if you caught the Woggles last night, these guys burned it down.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I got my sea legs back now. You know, I was.
No pun intended.
Jumping around.
Pun,
yes.
Pun intended.
All puns intended. Now, you folks know the lovely Palmyra Del Ran, right? Another DJ here at the on the Underground Garage channel, and she was telling me. Because there was actually a lot of the boat was rocking a lot last night. And before that, the people, she was saying, people keep telling me I got to take this Dramamine. But you know what? I got enough drama in my life.
Nice.
Good one.
That is a good one. So what, but I've got questions I want to ask you. So tell me again, what is the, what did we just hear?
That was a mashup of a song that closed out. A breakthrough record, what
Pressure
I would consider our breakthrough record, you know, from Pressure and Time. But that song was called Face of Light. And then in the middle, we sandwiched it, and just split in it, another closer from the album just prior to that, the EP. And the song
which we were talking
Sacred
backstage.
Tom.
It's a, we consider it a full length.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We were talking about...
It's called the EP, but when we talk about our records, we still consider that EP because it's, I think, maybe longer than Pressure.
It's an EP that identifies as a full length.
Yeah.
Right, so 8 albums, EP, which you could say maybe 9, a couple of 5 albums, 2 Grammy nominations. That's pretty awesome stuff, gentlemen.
I'd like to hear that from you.
Yeah.
It sounds good when you say it.
Yeah, well, that's my profession, man. I got to make that sound good, you know, the hype man like Bobby. Bobby Brown or something like that with James Brown, you know. So when we had spoken before, we were more talk. We talked about specific songs and things, but what I don't remember is ever sort of touching base with where you guys are actually from. And I when I got here earlier and I was talking with Jay a little bit backstage, that was pretty funny. Right on, spot on. He was like, "You're from Georgia," and I was like, "What? How do you know that?" It's like your accent. And I said, well, I've had people can hear from the South, but no one has ever nailed like the state that I'm from.
Georgia, Georgia's got a very particular sweet tea.
Oh, I do like sweet tea. That
you know,
is true.
It's got that very particular sweet tea sound.
But what about yourselves? Where are you guys from? I know you're from California, right? Both of you?
Yeah, we're both from Southern California. I grew up a bunch in Huntington Beach. I grew up a lot also... parents separated, grew up also in the high desert in California, which was really interesting, like on the edge of the Mojave Desert, you know.
They got bunkers out there in the Mojave Desert, you know.
Yeah, bunkers, snakes, all that good stuff.
They do. And you, where were you out? You said there were like trees or somewhere? I'm thinking, where in California are there trees? You said there were trees out there where you grew up.
Well, where I grew up. Well, I grew up in Wrightwood. And Wrightwood is a continuation of the Sierra Madre, you know, mountain range right there. Coming off of the Ring of Fire. Okay, lesson's over. Anyways, it's basically...
It just sounds cool when you say Ring of Fire with this get up. That's all I'm saying.
So you get... when you're down in L.A., you that whole, that tall mountain range, if the smog clears up enough for you to see it, there's a very large mountain range behind you to the east. And right up at the top of that mountain range... right behind Mount Baldy or Mount San Antonio, there's a little town called Wrightwood, and that's it's what separates the high desert, the Mojave Desert, and Los Angeles and the LA Basin and San Bernardino and like all of those agricultural areas.
But we met when we were in at the beach, like Huntington Beach, Long Beach, and we started a band together, and
right,
it was like
I'm
months
gonna interrupt
later.
This is what I heard you said when we met. So my understanding, there's when I looked up stuff online and all, I was talking about through MySpace. But did you know each other before that?
No,
we did not.
It was through MySpace.
Yeah.
I miss MySpace, man. That was such a simpler time. You know what I mean? You put all your songs on there.
Bring them back.
Yeah.
I miss the older days, too.
Yeah. Well, you know.
We had grown up, though, in the high desert, both of us, and not known until we were in a band together for months and just happened to start talking about our younger childhoods.
Okay.
And went, hey, wait a minute. Up there, and we were talking about music stores and different people and different shows, and we went, you got to be kidding me. Like, we were literally 30 miles from each other up there.
Wow. It's insane. And then, you know, we were talking about Huntington Beach, and he used to work at the Sugar Shack, It's a, you know, it's a Huntington Beach mainstay. It's a little breakfast joint. I used to, when he was working there, before we knew each other, long before we knew each other, I used to go in there and get breakfast all the time. So it means that we
I must have served this dude. Well,
there's
anomalous.
That song. Seriously. With the song, the Electric Man, in the parenthesis, it's like, take you to the Sugar Shack, or you're going to the Sugar Shack.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, a delightful euphemism there.
But it related on many different, you know, it was a double entendre, many, a triple entendre, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So when you guys are growing up, I mean, now you both play guitar. What were you hearing in your households? I mean, yeah, what was the music that was getting played at home?
Well, for me, it was a lot of KLOS, a lot of like Zeppelin, Beatles, Stones, Royalty of Rock, Pink Floyd.
Yeah. So you rebelled against that immediately.
It was ever present. Yeah. Hendrix, like this kind of like the mainstay that's like the royalty of rock. You know?
And this is like your dad, your mom, who was into this?
Both sides.
All right, wow.
My mom's side, you know, when she remarried, like probably even more. They were really very rock and roll family, younger, always having parties. So.
Wow. Do you have any older siblings? Or?
Nope, I'm the oldest.
Okay.
Younger siblings.
And yourself?
Oh, Jay? We had a lot of music going on. It's really interesting. I'm going to create a short byline here. From the time that I could remember up until I was about four, almost 5 years old, lot of jam sessions. All my friends, all my parents' friends were all musicians, artists, pickers. And stuff like that. And a lot of parties, and you could always, you know, see the adults, everybody just having fun, drinking and smoking joints and just having, like, living life and having fun. And then they got religion.
Wah, wah, wah.
And there was tons of great music, and then that record collection was gone. Really? And it was, I don't know, the Diet Coke of contemporary Christian music. It was a tough scene for Jay Bird
for
6 years after that.
How old were you when the hammer came down with all that?
I was almost 5 years old.
Oh man.
It was weird, but it was like I knew how dope all that stuff was. So there was no like
Mom, Dad, we gotta talk. I liked you guys better on joints.
Well, yeah, it was just like and it was cool. Like, you know, I had a great childhood and all of that stuff, but I was able to music was just everything to me. So I would collect tapes and steal tapes from my friends' parents.
Yeah.
Their collections.
We're like, talking about cassette tapes?
Yeah, cassette tapes.
I stole some tapes from aunties and uncles.
Yeah,
definitely.
You make a new friend, you're like, your parents got any records? Well, yeah. Why do you want to do that? Let's go outside and play. Let's look at those records.
Like
just
that.
Be a minute. Go into the kitchen.
So was there some point early on, was there like the epiphany, the moment where you decide this is what you want to do? Was that after you're actually learned an instrument? Or where is this moment where you decide this is where I need to be, like right here, right now, doing this, making music, singing, playing? Scott?
I think there's one moment that I think back to repeatedly. And I was visiting a grandmother, and an uncle had an apartment in the same complex, and we were having like a family party, and he's like, him and his buddy were over there, they're really young uncles, he's like, come over, I want to show you something. And I was probably 9 years old, and he takes me over to their apartment, which is super rad. It smells like weed. They have a giant Jimmy Page logo in the mirror, you know, and these like monstrous speakers, and they're playing Song Remains the Same.
Wow.
On Stun. Just on Stun, on like one of those old, you know, Marantz systems with tubes and stuff. And he goes, stand right here. And he puts me in front of the TV during the Page solo. And he just, all the way, just gooses it all the way up. And he let me just kind of feel it and watch it. And it completely brainwashed me.
Never heard that story before, man.
Wow.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's why we're here, Jay.
I remember walking out of that room like feeling different, feeling like,
so at that moment,
lifted.
But did you play any guitar or have fingered any chords before that? Or that's all that comes after that?
No, it comes right after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so right around 10, 11, I started having like a little Spanish guitar, little gut string.
And how'd you get the Spanish guitar? Your parents give you that?
Yeah, I think my stepdad brought it home for me, like from a pawn shop kind of thing. He's like, I found this, do you want it? Yeah.
And was it, were they, as your continued interest in music,
as you developed this interest in music going forward, were they supportive of what you were about?
Very supportive.
Oh, great.
Yeah. My parents, my mom said they were crazy. They let my band set up. We had like an audition on our living room, and they let the band set up full band with PA in the audition in the house.
Wow.
That's dedication, because I'm not doing that right now with my kids. We'll get a rehearsal room. My parents, like, we start rehearsing, and they'd call the aunties and uncles over and friends over and start drinking beers and, like, watching us play. So this was, like, our first gig.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's man. And yourself?
For me, I always wanted to play guitar. Music was, like, everything. It was, like, the only thing as a little kid that really, you'd learn things in school. And people would talk up a whole bunch of stuff at church. And music was the only thing that you could spot the honesty and you could spot the sales pitch. I think that young ears and your sensibilities, you're very attuned to who's telling the truth and who's not.
Yeah.
And I think that with music, you could hear. You can differentiate when you're being sold something.
Yeah.
And I think that when you could hear music that was really translating and someone was speaking their truth in a truthful way, it makes you feel really safe as a child, and it makes you feel welcome into their world. And I think that that's what I looked for. And that, you know, if there was one thing that I could say that I really liked growing up in church, it's getting to hear my mom sing. And she had that blatant, unavoidable honesty and vulnerability in her singing. And so few people would employ something like that, because it's not something that can be learned, you know, clinically.
Yeah.
You know, vocalists or, you know, musicians, they like, how do you really play with heart? Well, it's like, well, you play with heart. That's how you do it. You mean it. But getting to...
There's a ceiling at, like, technicality. There's a ceiling of, like, I learned how to play an instrument. I know all the modes. I know all the chords. I know, you know, I know how to play so many songs. There's a ceiling. That's what you do now. And the funny thing is what Jay's talking about, for me, this is like, you don't need any school. You pick the guitar up. You know no theory. You know nothing. You just touch an instrument and you sing from the heart. And this is like, you already have it. Yeah. Some people are like that. We hear old blues musicians that seem like they have very minimal technicality on the guitar or an instrument. They just don't need it because the music is here. It's not in this. It's in here.
And I think that being a kid and hearing that and knowing that that is an available thing on the salad bar of life, you go, I want all of that. I don't want anything else on my plate. And so from a very young age, like my father, he worked in the steel mill. My mom would scrub floors and clean houses and stuff like that. And, the idea of doing anything with your life that wasn't music just sounded like jail. It just sounded like jail, or like, you know, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you commit everything in your life to that? You know.
And so at what point were you like playing guitar?
I started playing guitar basically as soon as my hands were large enough. We had a beat-up old steel string acoustic guitar. It was a Monarch. It was a handmade guitar. And it was terrible. And it was so hard to chord or do anything. And the action was so high. And my pop never played it. He had like a Guild 12th string that he would play sometimes in church, and then he had his Gibson 335, and I wasn't allowed to touch those, but I could touch this beat up old hangover guitar. Yeah. And you try from a young age, and you remember this, you try to put your hands on it, it's like your hands are just too weak, they're too small to get anything done. And then as soon as I could start making a couple of box chords or whatever, it was immediately songwriting.
And who taught you those chords?
My pop taught me the G chord,
and
then the A minor, and then the D chord, and then C. And then that was basically it. And he didn't teach me anything else. I'd be like, hey, come on, you teach me how to do this.
Well, you got plenty of songs right there. Just mix them up.
But he made me teach myself how to play. And then my younger brother, he taught him how to play.
Your younger brother did what else again?
Yeah, but my younger brother, he plays guitar and sings. Okay. Chad, he's just tremendously talented. But anyways, I developed my own weird style and outlook. This thing is still a complete mystery to me, and I don't know how it works, but we get along.
Well, when you guys, you start figuring out things on the guitar yourself, you're pretty young. Yeah. And now let's get to you guys actually getting together. I mean, you had, was it the J. Buchanan Band that you were playing and fronting?
Yeah, I had a band. It was just called Buchanan.
And you were looking for something. You were looking for a singer.
Yeah, I had just come off of Atlantic with another band we had signed and got caught up in the web of being on a major label and spending way too much money and the label kind of melting away. So we had to try to scurry off with our record, which we didn't get. So I ended up making another go at it and starting another band. And looking for guys and kind of built my rhythm section and had another singer I was working with that was really great, but not really the thing.
Yeah.
Not really the thing I was looking for. And somebody had actually come out, a mutual friend of ours had come out to a show with when I had the other singer and like boldly out front after we played said, "You guys are the coolest band around, but you should have me sing for you." I'm like, "The singer's right over there. Yeah. Easy, dude." But he goes, "Yeah, here's my thing. Here's my MySpace. Go check it out. I want to sing for you guys. It'll be better. You guys will be great." I went and checked out his thing, and it was good, but it wasn't the thing either.
Yeah. This guy's a great vocalist that he's talking
about. Great vocalist. Oh, okay. Great guy, great vocalist. Okay. But he just happened to have Jay's icon on his six friends. Remember that?
Yeah.
He got six friends. Yeah. So he was one of the six friends, and I just it was really mindless just sitting there going like, "Oh, yeah, who's this guy?" Click. And then it was like maybe 13 seconds into it, I went,
"Here's my man.
That's my guy. This is the guy I've been looking for."
Now, initially, and you still have, who is it, Mike Miley's your drummer, right?
Yeah.
And he's still with you guys. And had he been playing with you before in this earlier band? Yeah,
we were already partners. And I told Miley immediately, I got this guy. I don't know where he lives, but I know his name. It's Jay Buchanan. And Miley was like, "I know Jay, and he's not going to join our band." He's like, "He doesn't care about rock and roll, and he's like, definitely isn't a guy that joins bands. He's doing his own thing. He is his own band." And I was like, "Okay, hit him up. I'm pretty sure he's going to join our band. I have a feeling." And we just kind of like...
So I read this thing about, what is it, the EP comes out, or maybe it's the Before the Fire or something. You know, I just read this online or something. Jay was not necessarily committed to the band at this point. He wanted to wait until the first album came out.
No, it really works like this. Like they had worked, you know, a long time on the Before the Fire record.
Yeah,
and he sent it to me with Thomas singing, and I heard it. I could hear it was really. I think it was Memphis Sun. That really got me. I go, out of all the songs.
Yeah.
It's like, "Oh, okay, well, that's psychedelic." And then you have these other things. They're all good songs. They're all great songs. But you're looking for, like, an identification.
Yeah.
You know, something that you really relate with. When I heard Memphis Sun, and I heard that stomping fat tail groove going on, and it just... And I went, "Wait, I think that's
too.
It. You know,
yeah,
I think that's the one."
Because really, for the most part, we were aiming at more, you know, very 66, 67, psychedelic, fuzzed out, kind of like hard, almost mod, kind of like that was
cool.
That was the lane.
Yeah.
And there was this one track that we just swung it around. And it was more of like a... I don't know what that's almost more of like a Stonesy kind of like dirge, like grit like that, but it still had a really mod kind of chorus thing that we did.
Yeah,
with him. But I knew when he came, I was like, "Don't worry about all those other things. Just do you. Like those songs will work with you. So just you do it. Like it's fine."
It was a very interesting situation though, because I knew they had worked on it. And so we got together and we jammed. It was like, okay, it's great. And then we did it, and it was basically like, okay, so we're going to do this. And I knew they had worked on this record, and what is it, just going to die? And so for me, I could have never imagined I would ever do this in my life. But I didn't write on that record or anything. But I went, I'll go into the studio, and I'll track vocals.
Yeah.
You know? And then so we went, and we did that. And it was, you know, like we needed to play. We needed material. We needed all of this stuff, and it was like, you know, it's terrible when good records die, and they die every day.
It really was like that. We really were like, the band's going to be different right now.
Yeah.
And me and him were talking. Like, I'm telling him, dude, the band's going to be different.
Yeah.
We're going to work together. That's the whole point. I didn't want to write all the lyrics and do all this on my own with this band. I wanted somebody to work with.
But now the live albums, though, Live at Catalina, do you play that first album? Before the Fire that you do?
We did Before the Fire. One funny story is when we went to the studio, Black Lion Studios over in Echo Park, our buddy Jeffrey Sines was engineering. So we're sitting there and I'm trying to knock out as many vocals as I can, staying familiar with the material, everything. Yeah. And Scott's there, and he would come in and be like, okay, no, hold on. I'd knock on the vocal booth. Listen, it actually goes more like this, and then like that, and then like that. And I'd be like, I remember saying, this is the last time you will ever be able to do this.
But I loved that. This is the guy I'm looking for. He has an identity.
Because these songs are his children, you know, I'm just wanting to switch everything up and rewrite everything all over the place like a goon. And but it was really funny. And then I remember feeling a little bit frustrated, but it's what I signed up to do, you know.
Yeah, right.
And then we got to On My Way.
Yeah. Well, Jay sung almost all the tracks in the day, just whipping it like minimal takes. But we got to On My Way, and we were listening in the room, and he got in there, jumped in the booth. All right, let's give it a go. Let's just grease it up and see where we get with it.
I had kind of had enough.
So he goes in there, and me and the engineer are listening, and Jay sings this take, and we're like it's like, you know, like just like you would think in a movie, like the tape stops, and we stop the tape, and the engineer looks at me, and I look at him, and he goes, Jesus Christ, dude, I don't think we can even do it again. And I went, I mean, should we do one more for like posterity? And he goes, why would you do that? And I went, we're not going to do it. And he walked in, he goes, how was it? And I go, that's it. That's the whole thing. Like, we're not going to cut anything else on that.
You're working with David Cobb now, right?
Yeah, Dave did that record too.
Okay, right. Yeah. This is your George Martin kind of guy, right?
Yeah, he has been.
Yeah. And so you were already familiar with him from this prior band that you had, or how did you come to work
with? Well, technically, this record we're talking about, Before the Fire, was the prior band.
Okay.
Yeah, and
okay.
Dave had done that. That's when I met Dave first. We did that record together.
So one of these early gigs, I saw something about you were playing the Indy 500.
Oh, yeah.
So were you, like, just inside the racetrack or something?
We were maybe the only still band to play the Indy 500 in the pits. So it's like pit crew. Rival Sons pointing at the audience playing on a little stage. Pit crew, yeah.
Little bit of Rival Sons trivia. We are actually the first band in history to ever play down on the bricks for Carb Day. The first band. Many bands have done it since, but we were the first ones in Indianapolis.
Well, we had spoken before, this was really interesting, that when you guys are going into the studio, we're talking about, I guess we're not speaking about Before the Fire, but the records after that maybe with Dave, where you guys were talking about how we don't go into the studio with the songs fully prepared. You know, I've got a riff, I've got some lyrics, we've got a sketch of what we're going to do, and then we're using that studio time, that pressure there to sort of make the songs happen. And like the title of the record, Pressure and Time, I think this would be like a pressure cooker. That would be really intense to have the clock running.
Yeah,
The meter running, and you got to come up with something that's worthwhile.
Yeah,
the amount of hubris.
We could have done this without a Dave Cobb. Those early records like that.
Yeah,
he was down. Dave was down to just let's see what happens. But it was really. I remember we were driving back from a U.S. tour, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're driving back from a U.S. tour. We had to get into the studio. We had signed with a death metal independent label out of Nottingham, England, called Earache, and we're getting ready to go into the studio. We're out on the road, and we're driving, just going, this is going to be fun. And he had a couple of ideas. I had a couple of ideas. But I didn't have, like, full-fledged songs or anything like that. You know,
it's like normal people making records like normal people. Write songs. Yeah. Know what you have. Go in the studio. Time's expensive. So you have it all kind of mapped, and you go in there, and you go knock it out. And there's still some improvisation, but this was a whole another level of I have a couple ideas, but they're not even with him yet, and his aren't with me yet. So we're just kind of... We're making the salad on the spot, just throwing it in the bowl and kind of
management asking the label, asking everything. So you don't have anything written.
Yeah.
And you're going in tomorrow? Yeah. Yeah, we're just going to write it on the spot. You know, the amount of hubris. You know, everybody's looking at us. People are investing in us. We're like, yeah, we'll do it. We'll do it on the fly. Sure.
I'm feeling really anxious just hearing this story.
We did have a lot of bravado. Yeah. We had a lot of confidence, but there was also a lot of oh shit in there. Yeah. Like, you know,
Was there ever any moment where you said, God, I can't believe they're letting us do this?
I mean, sure.
We're getting away with this.
Yeah, but there was not even time to really contemplate it. It was more like we're coming off tour, we're going in, and it was... we didn't have time to squeeze in the I can't believe it, because it was like coming off the road into the studio. Let's go. We are doing it.
Yeah.
There's no time for disbelief. It's like, let's do it. We'll figure it out.
Well, you did several records this way, though.
Yeah. Yes, we did.
So the...
In fairness, I had made...
Hollow Bones is the last one like that.
Hollow Bones was the last record that we made on the fly.
And then came the Feral Roots, right? You get signed to like Atlantic.
Uh-huh.
And that's, I mean, they're not going to put it, they're just like, did they put the hammer down?
No, nobody puts a hammer down on Rival Sons.
Yeah!
No, we talked about it.
Yeah.
We just thought like, oh, okay, well now we
did all those records like that. Let's do some records like this.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I had always been a take my time sort of writer and everything. It was really with Rival Sons. I'd never done that before. Yeah. I'd never put myself... You know, start climbing the rope and then light it on fire and just chaining yourself to the desk that way. It's incredibly stressful. I mean, it's incredibly stressful.
It makes a certain kind of song, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It makes a certain kind of a brand, and we like that brand.
Yeah.
And it works really well live, and it is a big part of our ethos, but we would have never got like songs that are on Feral Roots, like
tracking the song the second that it's written,
it captures.
You're hearing us play it for the first or third, you know, maybe fourth time.
Yeah,
and that's it. You know, and so we really wanted to capture that immediacy and that the honesty, trying to be as honest as we could.
So you kind of tap into that, and I want to bring this up in a moment, but because you're touching on it here, that the notion you did this. Had a recent solo album that came out, and a very similar thing. You go off into the desert, and you got to come up with the songs and all for that. First, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the Feral Roots album, because that's you had got the Grammy nomination for Best Rock Album. Is that right? Yeah, Best Rock Album, and also the what's the tune? Too Bad.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's like the first record on a major that you've got a Grammy thing. Must have felt pretty good, man.
Yeah.
It did.
Yeah, it felt great. It's really funny. That's sort of like a click, you know, a club like that. We had always looked at, the Grammys. What a shit show. Fuck those people. And then...
We're nominated again.
Yeah, and then you're like, maybe I could get one.
Forget that thing.
Obviously.
And then you don't want one until you think, well, maybe I could.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's like... start feeling like Gollum, you know? I really want that statue.
Start looking around your studio, clearing off a little spot.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe right over there to look good. Yeah.
It was really interesting. It felt good to get that kind of attention and to get a little bit of notoriety and recognition from our peers.
Yeah.
You know, it's a peer-based voting system with the Academy, and just to get a little bit of recognition, it feels good, and you get by without it because you're doing what you need to do,
right?
But the second you get it, you get a little pat on the back. It feels really good.
Well, and it's well earned too, you know.
You know what, there's one thing about it that as soon as we got those nominations in this industry, I don't know if you've heard, but it has a terrible reputation. You get things taken from you all the time. You get told, you know, as an artist, as a band, you get told, come on, just walk right through this door. We have everything prepared for you. The second you walk through, they slam it on your fingers. And over things get taken from you. You sign deals, you put out records, you do whatever, and everybody gets their piece. And then by at the very end, your piece is this big. And so you get taken advantage of, but it's part of the ride, and you do it because we have the music, and we have this thing. So all of these people that will come over and take $100,000 bites out of our sides every now and then, to have something in a Grammy nomination that cannot be taken away, to have a recognition that cannot be stripped of you, it can't be taken away by somebody, as the artist further and further becomes devalued in a society that does not value the artist, you know. This commodity is rapidly shrinking, and to be recognized and get something that can't be taken away, that means a lot. Yeah.
So we've got to get you guys to play and at least a few, play a little bit more. But I want to bring up, want to remind everybody, you're playing later on today. And that's up at the pool deck at 7 o'clock. And then on Monday, we confirmed this because I had the wrong day. It's Monday at 10:30 here, back here in the theater. Mm. One last thing I do want to ask you about. It came up backstage. You were talking about David Cobb, and you've got another record that you're working on, but he's not going to be involved with this one. You're going to self-produce it?
Yeah.
What's the story on the new album?
We co-produced the last record.
Okay.
Did quite a bit of work on that last one, and Dave also did great work on that one, but it made sense. It's a kind of a natural progression for us that we just take the reins on this one.
There are a couple of things to it, you know. Absolutely what Scott just said. Scott and I both produce other bands and everything. He's a fantastic producer. And, but it was really, the expenditure of time to go out to Savannah with Cobb, as you know,
yeah.
Cobb is a Georgia boy as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
But
I recognize his accent, you know,
Going out there and doing all of that, it doesn't really fit in with the things that are happening in life right now. And so we're looking at it, and we had to make that decision. Like, well, you know what? I think this is probably the universe telling us that it is time. Yeah. It is time for us to make a record in this manner. You know, we can certainly, be at the helm there. It's a very natural thing.
So these shows that you'll be playing on board here, are there any newer songs from the forthcoming album we might hear bits of?
No, or not yet. We're gonna keep it pretty raw, so we're not playing any of the songs yet.
Yeah, okay.
We probably won't play any of the songs till we go in.
What are you gonna play for us now?
We're gonna play something for you right now, though.
What are we gonna hear now?
Well, let's play play Where I've Been.
Okay. We'll play some heartstrings.
All right. Well, I'm gonna give you the stage back. All right, I'll give you a stage back, but I want to thank you guys again for joining us for a very special conversation.
Ed, thank you.
It's an honor to talk with you, man.
Thank you, Manfred.
All right.
She said, since we've been together, I've tried not to keep secrets. I was so lost then, I don't like to talk about it. See, I needed money because the habit wasn't cheap. I gave them my money. won't let me sleep. Now I lay beside you, and when you touch me, I feel like I don't deserve you. That's when you remind me. She said, how could you love me when you know? When I came home, I tried to put myself back together. The war's still going on, and all my brothers are still in danger. Now now I lay beside you, and when you touch me, I feel like I don't deserve you. And that's when you remind me. He said, how could you love? You know where I've been. How could you love me when you know where I've been? How could you love me when you know?
Hey, thanks, everybody.
That was Jay Buchanan and Scott Holiday of the Rival Sons performing live on this year's Underground Garage Cruise several weeks ago. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to both gentlemen for joining me and making the event so special. Thanks also to the production crew on the ship and our very own Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Last year, noted 60s band The Zombies remastered and reissued their seminal album Odyssey and Oracle in glorious mono, and they've recently done the same to their debut album Begin Here. Lead singer Colin Blundstone will tell us all about the project on our next Coolest Conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.